All right, I'm on Skype with Dr. David Jacobs. How you doing, David?
Fine, thank you, Martin.
And thanks for joining us. And you are a retired professor of history at Temple University. And are you still keeping active?
Well, yes, I am. I'm working on my books. I've been claiming to do this for a number of years now. And it's very slow going, but I'm actually making a pretty good headway with three books that I'm doing.
Well, I have listened to interviews with you in the past, and I really appreciate the work you've done. I also appreciate your stance, and because I felt, although you felt this way many, many years ago, when I started getting into this whole phenomenon, I also was rather skeptic of abductees and all that. But I always believed in Betty and Barney Hill. I lived in the Portsmouth, New Hampshire area, and I always thought Travis Walton's story was really solid. So, you know, I started becoming a little bit more open-minded. And that's kind of, can you kind of explain your beginnings in UFOs and how you eventually got involved in the abduction aspect?
Well, I got interested in the UFO phenomenon when I was an undergraduate at UCLA. This was back in the 19-teens. And for some reason or another, I just got interested in it. I have no explanation for it. I never saw anything.
Wait, excuse me. Did you say the 19-teens?
Well, let's just say the mid-1960s. It's all the same to me now.
Okay. All right.
And then once I started reading in it in 65 and 66, it really kind of captured my imagination even more. By the time my wife and I went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin in 1966, I was already pretty much obsessed with the subject. And unfortunately, I inflicted that obsession on my friends in Wisconsin, who I'm sure grew really tired very quickly of hearing me expound about UFOs. I remember thinking that the UFO phenomenon was going to about to present itself. I fell prey to these. Now I realize wrong-headed ideas that they were going to land on the White House lawn. There was going to be a big sort of disclosure by the aliens themselves of their presence. And I remember thinking, it's 1970 now. This is the year it's going to happen. The first year of the decade, 1970. And pretty soon, obviously, predicting behavior of these objects and what they're going to do is an inexact science, to say the least. And so I was very, very much into the whole world. By 68, I had become a field investigator, quote unquote, for the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. And I was actually knocking on doors and doing footwork and following up on cases in the Madison, Wisconsin area and all. And I just sort of kept with it. And eventually I wound up, when I was starting to write my dissertation in history, I was very much interested in social cultural history, and I spent 6 months doing a dissertation, doing research for a dissertation about the image of women in a very early film history, pre-1915. And I did 6 months of that, all the while obsessing on UFOs. And so I eventually went to another professor to work with, and I changed my dissertation to the controversy over unidentified flying objects. And wound up getting my PhD in that, only the second PhD ever awarded with an area of UFO studies in it in some way. Although,
wow.
That was in 1973, but the subject wasn't about UFOs itself. It was about how the society and segments of the society treated the subject over the years to get to the point that by 1973 we didn't know anything at all about UFOs. And why was that? Why did that come about? Why don't we? And that book was eventually published by the University of Indiana Press in 1975. So since then, I just got, I kept doing it. Barney and Betty Hill, interesting case, came about, abducted, who knows. With UFO researchers, you're looking for patterns. And if you don't see patterns, you're not seeing anything. You know what I mean? You're seeing something that is not really unusual. So UFOs had to fit into a pattern, and they did fit into a pattern. Same thing with abductions. With abductions, if you don't find a pattern, there's nothing to it. One case does not a pattern make. Mm-hmm. So, Betty Hill were not contactees, the charlatans from the 1950s who claimed to take rides to the moon and to Venus and to Uranus and get the secrets of the universe and also the secrets of their propulsion system. This was really, really big in the 1950s, particularly amongst charlatans, but also amongst serious UFO researchers too. They, for some reason or another, it still escapes me, they were fixated on propulsion. But
speaking of propulsion, what's that in the background I hear?
Oh, somebody's mowing their lawn.
Oh, okay, all right. I thought it was a mothership, perhaps.
If you want to wait a second, I can close a second window.
Sure, okay.
Here we go. Walking to the window. I'm about to close it.
So where were we going?
So the point is that I was not a great believer in abductions. I mean, it was UFOs were the end all and the be all. This is where the Air Force entered in. This is where the CIA entered in. This is where presidents had this, you know, statements about them from time to time. This is where scientists look at. Nobody looked at abductions. Nobody. And I certainly wasn't going to, because the UFOs was where I was centered. Although the Barney Betty Hill case was interesting, no doubt about it. It wasn't until 1982 when I met Bud Hopkins that I became interested in the abduction phenomenon. He sucked me into his lair, and I remained there ever since. And Bud and I became very, very, very close friends for the rest of his life, actually. Mm-hmm. So Bud and I kind of worked in tandem. We shared the same abductees from time to time, especially if they moved to Philadelphia or moved up to New York. But we shared information mainly. That was the key thing. Trying to figure out what is going on here. How can we address this? And what kind of assumptions can be made and all that. However, historians work. They work alone. History is a lonely field. You work alone primarily in history. Every once in a while, there'll be two historians who write a book, but 99% of the time, it's a singly authored study. And so that's basically what I did. I worked alone in this field for a long, long time, and still working in it from time to time, although in recent months, in the last year, things have slacked off considerably for me. I think mainly because I'm retired now. I need to do these books. I don't follow up on people who write to me. Unfortunately, I'm sorry for everybody out there who might be a victim of me. And so I'm elderly now. I'm an old man now. And I know I got to get these books out of my system. And once that's done, I'm going to hang up my brains and I'm just going to watch television and I'm going to be happy.
Well, that's good. At least we'll know what happened to you.
So right.
That's good. I want to know what kind of issues has doing what you've done caused you in your academic profession? Has it caused you any trouble?
Well, let's put it this way. Yes.
Okay.
This is not a subject that you want to deal with in academics. Academics can be fairly closed-minded, mm-hmm. especially when it comes to being abducted by little beings from outer space. That just doesn't make it into the academic world. It doesn't make it in intact, let's put it that way. The problem is that most academics understand instantly, or faster than instantly, a whole range of psychological issues that could allow people to present with abductions. I've been abducted. They know about hypnosis. They know about psychological problems. They know about all sorts of things that can account for this, picking things up in popular culture. They get it right away. They understand the whole spectrum. Mm-hmm. Therefore, to say you're an abduction researcher means automatically that you're an idiot. Hmm. Because you're not researching anything that is actually real. You're researching a combination of different fields of things, you know, for a sociologist, a mass hallucination or whatever it is. And therefore, your judgment is called into question and really not a legitimate academic, basically. You know, there's something wrong with you, you know. And that's the way people who do this kind of work in academics are treated. Now, when I say that, there aren't a whole lot of people in academics who do this kind of work.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. In fact, there are none who do hypnosis with abductees. There used to be some, but unfortunately, they got old, they retired, or in a couple of cases, they died heart disease and cancer and things like that. And now I was left as the only one, I think. And I'm not sure. Maybe some people are doing it on the slide that I don't know about. But I think I was the only one left. As a result, my first book was Straight History, the UFO Controversy in America, but when I published Secret Life and then The Threat, which was simply considered not history. Now, I had tenure, and the tenure system, which is now under serious attack throughout the country, unfortunately. Without tenure, I would not have been able to do this within an academic setting. Mm-hmm. Tenure protected me from being fired outright.
Mm. Wow.
So if people say, well, tenure's no good, it's got to go, they don't know what they're talking about. It protects academic freedom. That's what it was set up for, and that's what it does do. Mm-hmm. So, but in fact, it stopped my career basically in its tracks. And the way the academic world works is, if you're an assistant professor, that means you're a professor without tenure. You have not received tenure yet. If you're an associate professor, that means you have tenure. You were granted tenure by the Board of Trustees of Temple University, already recommended by the chair, the dean, the council of deans, the provost, the president, and then the Board of Trustees. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who grant tenure, and that is what happened in 1981 for me. And then I published The Threat. I mean, Secret Life and The Threat. And the next step up is full professor. That means that you have national recognition in your field. A full professor is the end step. It's wonderful. It's great. Everybody wants it. And of course, I wanted it. That would never happened. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then when you retire at Temple University, you have a way of retiring with emeritus status. That is to say, meritorious service. Mm-hmm. And technically, you're still on faculty then, see? Hmm. Means you have all sorts of privileges that you can use the faculty dining room. You can do this. You can do that. There's all sorts of privileges you get because you're still on faculty. But I was not granted that either. That was the sort of the final cut. And, you know, it left me with a certain amount of bitterness. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I walked into it eyes open. I knew that this was going to have a deleterious effect on my career. I knew that this was not good. And the situation is as follows. People would call me up, graduate students in history and in other areas, sociology, psychology, and so forth, who wanted to do a dissertation involving UFOs or abductions, and I just tell them to stay the hell away from it.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. If you could start all over again, turn back the clock, would you take the same path?
Yes, I would. You know, one does not get the opportunity to make a contribution in something that is potentially of overwhelming importance. And the work I would have done in history would have been important for historians and maybe even change the way we look at the past a little tiny bit. But nothing approaches the importance of the abduction phenomenon, especially and the UFO phenomenon, which, in my opinion, are one and the same thing. And to be an academic working in this really was something that was not unique, but there were very few people who did that, and so I had this opportunity. And I took it. I mean, my priorities in terms of making a contribution, I think, were greater than my priorities for my own particular life.
Wow.
Now, just to follow up on this last thing that I was saying, when graduate students call me up, I tell them to stay the hell away from it because the following things happen. If they work in a subject other than UFO cults, UFO religions, or the psychology of people who see UFOs, which everybody does. If you look at academic press books, they're all related in some way or another, or most of them are anyway, to UFO religions, UFO cults, popular culture, and UFOs, you know, but not addressing the UFO or abduction for some phenomenon per se. There is one book by Susan Clancy that does
yes.
it. It is the world's worst book.
I was going to talk to you about that and what your opinion was of her work.
It's factually incorrect on the one hand and just stupidly done, in my opinion. And I certainly don't want to upset her by saying things like that. That's just my opinion. I've already upset her in a number of other ways. But it's just not a very good book. The problem is the book was not edited. It was not refereed. They didn't send it to me, for example, or I would have ripped it apart and made it into a better book.
Hmm.
But they decided not to do that. And Harvard University Press published this book raw without any serious person looking at it. And it came out, it was horrible, just horrible. And not horrible because she's a skeptic. That's just fine. It was horrible because, as I said, it was just incorrect. Her facts were wrong. Things like that.
Yeah, but, you know, being in print, it's out there, and a lot of people are going to take that path of believing her.
Damage, it upgrades her career, and it does damage. But mm-hmm. here's the problem. If you do write a book that confronts the subject, you will never get a job in academics. And the reason is, if you find that there's something there, like Susan Clancy, if you find something is going on, something is happening, you're just reinventing the wheel. Everybody knows that's the case. What kind of a dissertation is this? It's common knowledge that people are not being abducted. You will never get a job. If you find out that something indeed is happening, that people are being abducted, you are nuts. You will never get a job in academics. Sidney Clancy never got an academic job, a tenure track position. Nor did a woman who wrote a book for the University of California Press called The Lure of the Edge. As far as I know, she never got a job either. And that was not a bad book, even though it was skeptical. So I tell them, wait, go into something else, wait till they get tenure, then move into UFOs and abductions. But it's not going to happen for you otherwise. It pains me to say that. But ethically and morally, I have a feeling that I just have to tell people what the downside of this subject is, and it's mainly downside. There isn't a whole lot of upside to studying the abduction phenomenon, not a whole lot at all. In fact, none.
Wow. Well, let me ask you a question. Oftentimes, you hear about the commonalities in these abductions, and this is under hypnotic regression. Let's just take an example. If you interviewed someone, say, in the United States, and then you happen to interview someone in, say, Africa, have you had commonalities with these two types of situations?
They all say the same thing. This is a phenomenon that cuts across all ethnic lines, all religious lines, all national lines, all economic lines, all intellectual lines, all educational lines, all everything lines, all racial lines, whatever it is, it cuts across it. And in fact, I did have a guy from the West African country of Mali who said the same thing as everybody else. I had a woman from India said the same thing as everybody else. People, I have a person from Lithuania, people from Latin America. It does not matter. We have people who are MDs, PhDs, LLDs, psychiatrists, psychologists, university teachers, etc. They all say the same thing as people who've dropped out of school early on and could never hold a job and that sort of stuff. All say the same thing. Those are patterns. Without that, we wouldn't be talking, Martin.
Yeah. Now, when you say this, is there any way that these people can get knowledge of what a typical abduction is?
There used to be no way whatsoever. And when I wrote Secret Life, I would say that 75% of the information in that book had never been made public. Then when I wrote The Threat, a large percentage of it, maybe another 75%, had never been made public. Maybe 50%, just to give debunkers their due. I'm now writing another book where a large part of it has not been made public. But you know, a lot of people say this, that they're picking it up in popular culture. It's in the media. It's everywhere. Actually, it's not. And most people who come to me are more than acutely aware of two things. They don't want to be led in hypnosis. In the first place, they're scared to death of hypnosis. They think that I'm gonna burrow into the private areas of their personal lives, you know, something that I'm not interested in, and something that once they do the hypnosis the first time, they realize it's never going to happen. So they don't want to be led. They don't want to be led. They're afraid of it. They don't know what hypnosis is. And they don't want to pick up things. I should say they don't want to be led by me. And they don't want to pick up things in popular culture and then say them back to me as if it happened to them. Virtually everyone knows that. They're all aware of it. They when they come to me, they sort of know what they're getting into, and they know hypnosis, and they're frightened of it, and they're wary of it. After one session, when they realize hypnosis means they're just relaxed, and the way I do it, they just relax, and they're thinking about the unbelievably stupid questions that I'm asking them, and whether they should even bother to answer them, they know they are in control. And they're not in some sort of trance. This is a misnomer if there ever was one. And there's ways to find out whether people are vulnerable to suggestion. You know, people said, you know, even if you say the word uh-huh, as somebody says something and you say uh-huh, it spurs them on to false memories. Well, I have never ever found that to be the case, not even once. However, I have found that there are some people who will be led. You can put an idea in their mind directly and they'll pick up on it. And I have put into place controls which militate against that. And if somebody can be led, I am excruciatingly careful. And oftentimes, they have to tell me things that everybody else has said, and not knowing whether other people have said those things. That's the critical event. Also, if somebody tells me something for the first time, it's not evidence. It goes on the back burner unless I've known this person for years and years and they themselves are well aware of what is happening. Like, this has never happened to me before. I don't know what to make of it. You know, in other words, and I know that they're trustworthy and very careful in their testimony. But by and large, it goes in the back burner. I wait for other people to say the same thing who are unaware of it. And you put in deliberately misleading questions. I know if people ever looked at a history transcript, they'd see me asking off-the-wall questions, but they're deliberately done to see whether the person will bite, see whether they'll say yes to it. There's a whole list of questions that I ask like that, especially in the first couple of sessions. One of the questions I used to ask years ago was, when you look on the floor as they're walking in the object, people report seeing a parquet floor. you can see that parquet floor, can't you? A parquet floor is wood that's placed at odd angles to each other in sort of squares. And there's never been a case of that, ever. So I say that this is usual. This is what people see. People say, no, I don't see any parquet floor. You know, like, I'm sorry, but I don't see. You know, the floor I see is smooth and it's gray and it looks like it's made out of metal or whatever it is. And I had one person once who said, yes, I can see the parquet floor. I knew I had to be very, very careful with this person. This was back in the 1980s when I was still beginning. But it's extremely rare. Now, does that mean that people will say things that are not true? No, it doesn't mean that. I mean, people will say things that are not true all the time, especially in the first session, less so in the second session, less so in the third session, and much less so in the fourth session, and sometimes nothing. But in fact, in other sessions, but in fact, most people confabulate. They say things that they think are true. They're not lying. That they are seeing whatever they are describing, or what is happening to them is actually happening to them, or what the aliens are saying to them is actually being said. But I have learned by looking at about 1,500 abduction events or whatever it is, 1,200 abduction events, that there is something called confabulation that takes place in certain specific areas, and I can identify it very quickly. Thank God I was burned enough in the early days to learn quickly that I had to be very, very careful. The key thing, though, is that I have worked with people who, like I said, are psychiatrists, a psychologist, you know, people like that, who know all these things also and who are very, very, very careful in what they say to me. Even then, they will confabulate. Mm-hmm. And the reason for it is because the abduction phenomenon itself plays with people's imagery and it plays with people's memory. And they have to get used to filtering out themselves and understanding what is actually happening and what is not. The hardest thing to do, confabulation comes in a bunch of different areas, but the top three are, number one, description of aliens. This is especially true in the first session. Which is why you get people like James Harder years ago who would get up at the 1992 MIT conference on abductions and say that there are over 200 different aliens visiting Earth, you know, as evidence was from abductee testimony. The answer is that's not true. The answer is there's this confabulation. People can confabulate all over the place in the first one or two sessions. Hmm. That's number one area. Number two area is interpreting alien speech or telling me what the aliens are saying. Describing alien dialogue. The aliens told me, and then you just fill in the blank. Now, the problem here is, if all communication is telepathic, and it is and always has been, if all communication is telepathic with aliens on board the object, and telepathy means that they're hearing something in their mind, and they are in an altered state of consciousness as it is, so that they're passive on board this object, so they can't run, they can't, come up with a gun and blow somebody's little alien's head off or something like that. They're passive. What's to prevent them from hearing their own thoughts in their minds and assuming it's coming from the outside, from an alien? And the answer to that is nothing prevents that. They do it all the time. It's number two on the list of confabulation. So when people say, the aliens told me, and then they just fill in, you know, it's up to people who understand this phenomenon to be exceptionally careful with that. Aliens sometimes do say things, and so do hybrids. They say things too, and it can be trusted. But there's a specific and certain way that they talk, and if I don't hear that, it becomes very suspicious to me. So that's number two. And the third area is interpreting alien motivations, goals, and purposes. Most abductees have no idea why they're there. And if they describe, you know, instruments that might be used on the machines, and you'll say, well, what do you think this machine is for? Oh, well, it's looking at my bones. Yeah, it's looking at my bones. The answer is they don't know that. They're guessing. Because unless the aliens specifically tell them that the technology they're using is doing such and such, then there's no way they can know. They're just guessing. Even though they think that they're guessing correctly, they're not usually. Oh, they might be, but usually they're not. Because we're looking at very different kinds of technology here. So, and then there's a lot of other areas too. So hypnosis is tricky. Now, having said all that, there are incompetent hypnotists out there, usually with religious, spiritual, new age, transformational agendas, who have something in mind about what the abduction phenomenon is. And they are certain that they are right. When an unfortunate victim comes into their office for hypnosis, they will specifically try to interpret what the abductee is saying in a religious or spiritual or transformational way, and there's a lot of other areas that go in here too, to conform to their own ideas of what this phenomenon is, rather than be dragged along kicking and screaming as I have been to the area, to what is actually happening, and not feeling any idea of what I might have, and not caring one whit about my sensibilities about it. That's the proper way it should be. But for these other ones, people come out of hypnosis and they think, oh my God, these are wonderful light beings. And you know, there was music of the spears and we danced to it. I danced with the aliens. Oh my God, it was so wonderful. Well, I have never heard that ever, not even close. Neither did my colleague Bud Hopkins ever heard that. And between the two of us, maybe we looked at 3,000 different abduction events. Never, ever heard that. That's not a good sign because you're looking for patterns, you know, and all that. Then you have to look at the hypnotist. That's the problem.
Right. Since you started in the 1980s, have you seen any consistent changes with what people are saying?
Yes.
Can you explain what they are?
Well, in the 1980s, we heard the standard format for which Secret Life was based on. Take somebody up, take their clothes off, bring them into a room, do this to them, do that to them, do this to them, do that to them. Reproductive activity, taking sperm, eggs, implanting fertilized ova, removing fetuses, doing machine-type examinations, every conceivable kind of machine imaginable, and looking at babies, holding babies, dealing with babies, and then out. In the 1990s, I began to hear more and more about the babies who are now growing up and were toddlers, were, although Bud Hopkins' book Intruders had a toddler in it, and who are young children and older children and adolescents and young adults and adult adults and not older adults for some reason or other, and that still holds true. And that was interesting, and I wrote The Threat based on hybrid abductee interactions to a large extent. Now, starting in 2003, approximately, I began to hear stories about hybrids that did not necessarily, that were not taking place on board a UFO, although some of the hybrid stories that I talked about in The Threat were also like that. But this was different. This was hybrids who were now having activities with abductees, going places, moving into apartments, and the abductees were helping them. And that was the major shift. Now, in The Thread, I talked about something called the change that these beings, hybrids and aliens, were talking about was coming soon. Over and over and over again, I was hearing this. I had no idea what soon meant. I didn't know when it was going to happen. But they were talking about basically integrating into the society. That was the impression I got. In 2003, I realized that this was now happening. and that there was a process and a bureaucracy involved with this as more and more people began to say these things. And that's what the book I'm just finishing up now is all about, the processes and bureaucracy of integrating into the society. How do you do that? What are the pitfalls of it? What are the problems that they're having? All that sort of stuff. And that's in other words, there's been change over time. And what I realized when I wrote the threat was that this was not what I thought it was. What I thought it was in Secret Life, for example, was this was a study. They were learning from us. That's why they were abducting us. Barney and Betty Hill, they examined them, didn't they? Therefore, they were learning. And that's obviously true. They were learning something. I held on to that for longer than I should have. Bud held on to that for longer than he should have, too, I must say. And So that was behind my brains when I wrote Secret Life. But by the time I got to the threat, I realized that the study model, that they were studying us, learning about us, it was educational in some way, that just wasn't in the evidence. It was not holding. The more we learned about it, the more we realized this was not the case. This was a program with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it was goal-directed. It had a purpose in mind. And that fit the evidence, and that still fits the evidence. And so the question is then, well, what is the goal? What is the purpose? And well, it is this what these aliens and hybrids said, just straight out, well, soon we'll be living with you. Soon we'll be here, and we'll be here in a society, you know. And that's what I've been finding out, and that's what my book is, a latest book will be about. Even though I'll probably have to have it printed up at the corner print shop. But other than that, I'm going to publish it in some way, and people will now know the latest in terms of the movement that I've seen in the abduction phenomenon.
If you had to guess why you would think they'd want to live with us, what would your guess be?
That is the major question. I do not know. Abductees don't know. Hybrids who are moving in don't know. In other words, this is the jackpot question. Why is this happening? What is the purpose of this? And you have to remember, this is a global phenomenon. This is not, you know, located on the East Coast of the United States or the West Coast or whatever. This is a global phenomenon. We don't have a corner on the abduction market. And so we don't know that. Now, the interesting thing about that is that if this were a psychological phenomenon and with abductions, it's either psychological, it's emanating from one's brain for whatever reason, with psychiatric or physiological, whatever reason, it's emanating from somebody's brain, or it's happening, one of the two. If this were psychological, we'd know the answer, because people would make it up, just like they've made everything else up. Why would they stop there? In other words, say, well, they're trying to bring world peace, like the old charlatans used to say in the 1950s. They want to stop atomic war. They want to kill communists. They want to bring world peace. They want to all join together in friendship and sing kumbaya or whatever it is. There was a reason. There was always a reason why they were visiting us here. But with the abduction phenomenon, we do not know that reason. I wish I did, but I'm going to go to my shallow grave one of these days and not knowing, I think.
Yeah. Of all the debunkers that have debunked or tried to debunk the work that you're doing, why don't you give an example of that situation and your argument against it?
Well, you know, debunkers are ignorance-driven. That's the engine. Ignorance is the engine which allows them to be debunkers. And so they are very carefully ignorant. They make sure that they don't ever learn about the abduction phenomenon at all. And so consequently, you have arguments against it, which rely, for example, on sexual abuse. This sexual abuse in children who repress it and it comes out as having sex with aliens when they're older. The answer to that is there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that is true. There's no academic evidence. There's no papers printed on the subject, as far as I know. Maybe there has been, that escaped me. And it would be interesting to see one if there was. But there's no evidence that I can tell that that is the case at all. Not at all. I've worked with people who were sexually abused. They know the differences between what their uncle did to them and what was happening in the other phenomenon. They know it immediately, right away. There's no question in their minds.
Isn't that Susan Clancy's main argument?
Her argument is partially, though, she has a scattershot thing. She throws that in, I think, as I remember, and I have to search my ever-diminishing memory. But I think her argument is sleep paralysis to a large extent, because that was sort of de rigueur when she was writing the book. And popular culture, Betty and Barney Hill saw a show called The Outer Limits, which had small aliens in it. Therefore, they saw, you know, in their dreams these aliens. Of course, Susan Clancy did not see the show, and she didn't realize that there weren't small aliens in it. There was only one alien, and he was big. She said with wraparound eyes, and they didn't have wraparound eyes. They were large eye sockets, but they were normal looking eyes. Interestingly, and she never saw the show. She just guessed. Hmm. So we know what other debunkers have said, and debunkers are always wrong. They have no knowledge, so that's how they come up with their ideas. But there is sleep paralysis, which is now being presented, and the majority of the cases that I have looked at, it's not a great majority, but it is the majority, take place when the person was not asleep.
Really? Wow.
Period.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that before. Uh-huh.
Right. Not only that, but we didn't even have any cases in the first several years of the abduction phenomenon. It was Barney and Betty Hill were driving, and there were other people who were driving, and people were awake, and this and that. And then later on, people began to say, and we began to realize through hypnosis that people were being abducted in the middle of the night and didn't even realize it. Here's the thing about debunkers. They all do one of three things. Number one, they don't know the evidence. That's the linchpin of it. That's where it rests or resides there. That's where it lies. Number two, they know the evidence and they just ignore it. That's where the craziness comes in. They can't believe the evidence. They ignore it. It's no good, blah, 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 blah. That allows them to be ignorant. Number three, they distort the evidence. Oh, he said this, but what he really meant was this. Therefore, it's sleep paralysis. He thought he was awake, but actually he was asleep. You know, in other words, they just distort the evidence so to conform to their own idea of what this is all about. Now, the problem here is that people are physically missing from their normal environments when they're abducted. They come back with unusual, fully formed scars on their body, something biologically impossible that I know for an absolute fact were not there the day before, because with one woman I did a session with her, and the next day I saw her and there were two about 1 inch scars on her hand, on each hand, in exactly the same place, that were not there the day before. And they also are abducted in groups where people can see each other being abducted and sometimes confirm each other's abductions if they can remember it, or if they go to somebody who is a hypnotist who's in connection with another hypnotist, and, you know, they can compare notes. Oftentimes, and sometimes, rather, people just see them on the ground being abducted and are not abducted themselves. Once you have that, all psychological arguments, and remember, it's either psychological or it's happening, all psychological arguments fall. They're made mute, period. You cannot have a group of people seeing somebody being abducted or being all abducted themselves, all having slightly different experiences and confirming each other's abductions, unless they're in some sort of criminal collusion or whatever it is, you know, to get some poor jerk like me to believe their story and then laugh about it to themselves and never, ever, ever make it public. It doesn't make any sense on any level for them to do that. You have to remember that when people come forward with their stories, they understand extremely well that there's all downside to this and no upside. Mm-hmm. To say, as a high-functioning person, a person who's an MD, that they are an abductee, they have been abducted by people from another world or whatever it is not a really good career move for them to make. It's not going to help them in their practice. You know what I mean? It's not going to help them with their friends either, nor with their spouse necessarily. It's all downside. It's no upside other than knowing what has been happening to them since they were children, because this is an intergenerational phenomenon, and it starts very early on and goes all the way through into old age. At least it gives them some sort of closure about what in the devil has been happening to them. But it does not enrich their lives outside of it. They don't make money off the deal, although one or two in the entire history of the deduction phenomenon have tried to. It's all downside, you know. So that's why really high-functioning people don't come forward. I can't get them to go on television. I don't want them to. I know it could be calamitous for them. It's awful. So we're sort of encased in this world of wanting to tell the story, wanting high-functioning people, actors, actresses, politicians to come forward. We know that's never going to happen because it will destroy their careers.
Right. You mentioned just a few minutes ago about, you know, witnesses seeing, you know, someone being abducted. Now, I saw something, it was probably on YouTube a while back, where there's claimed to be some surveillance tape of seeing someone being abducted. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
Yeah, I have. And there was not being abducted necessarily. No, I haven't seen that. But somebody sort of being in a place and then not being in a place.
Maybe that's the same one I'm thinking of.
Yeah, it was black and white. It was.
That's right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I've seen that. You know, the thing is this: with all the surveillance cameras around, and I would imagine there's about 10 on every corner in the country, and every story, houses have them now too. They're all over the place. You'd think we'd be seeing zillions of abductions all the time. The problem is that now here comes something that I first talked about in public. First was to talk about this in public, I think, in 1991 in Santa Barbara at a conference. The problem is that people are rendered unseeable just before they are abducted. So when they go through a wall or when they go through a window or something like that, normally people cannot see them from the outside. Where the screw up is when people can see them, like the Brooklyn Bridge sightings of the case, the witness case from Bud Hopkins with Linda Cortile. Every once in a while, there's some sort of a mistake made, and that I think Bud didn't, but I think it was a mistake. He thinks it was a display. I don't think so. But the fact is, though, that people can't be seen. I had one person who was taken out of his dorm room at a major East Coast Ivy League university at 12 noon, and he could look down as he was floating up into this object and see people walking not that far from him. Nobody was looking up in awe and pointing and screaming and yelling and running or anything like that. They just couldn't see him. Now, without that, there would be no abduction phenomenon. Without that ability to render people invisible, unseeable—I don't care what phrase you use—there would be no abduction phenomenon because we know all the abductees and we know how to prevent it. We figure out ways, you know. That's a very important part. It is, of course, ridiculous. You can't make people invisible. Unfortunately, that is what does happen, and we can't get around it. We can't get away from it. Maybe it's a cloaking device. I don't know what it is, but people cannot be seen when they're taken. That's why when you see a person who's there and then not there, the question is, in this sort of video that's been released, how many times a second did that camera take a picture? And was it a smooth, in other words, we have to know about the camera, was this smoothly done the whole time so that the person actually did disappear? And did the person reappear in the same place, essentially, a couple hours later? The camera'd still be on.
Right.
We don't know about that either, you know.
Yeah.
And who was that person? And was that person an abductee? Because if he wasn't an abductee, then he didn't get abducted. And we can tell that because it starts in infancy and goes into old age. So there's a lot of checks that had to be made and investigations, none of which were done as far as I know. So the answer to that video then is, gosh, I don't know.
Yep. Okay. Now, you just mentioned just a second ago about starts in infancy and goes into old age. Why would you suppose that is the case?
Well, we don't know why that's the case exactly. We know that that abductees have one thing in common, and the thing they have in common is that their mother or their father was an abductee before them, or both. And so it's intergenerational. Now, Bud Hopkins discovered this in the 80s, and it has stayed that way ever since. In other words, we don't see exceptions to that. For actual abductees, sometimes there's opportunistic abductions. For example, an abductee will be abducted when they're driving with several people, and the whole car will be taken. The people are switched off. They're sort of put to sleep in a way. But technically speaking, they are abducted, whereas all the other procedures for the normal abductee is done. Then they're put back in the car, and they all arrive at their location. And an hour or two late, they can't figure out what happened. Everything seemed to go smoothly. But the fact is, though, that this intergenerational quality is sort of an iron-like link. And it starts early on. And it starts, we think, in infancy, because people have reported being abducted with their babies. And when people say, my earliest abduction was at the age of 6 and 9, or my earliest abduction was at the age of 12, we know that that's when they first are remembering something odd happening. And before, their brain was not organized well enough to remember things like that. Like, people do not have complete memories of when they were 6 months old, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and it goes into old age. Now, why this happens this way, we don't know. There might be a genetic aspect to it, which is what I'm leaning to. That genetically abductees have the ability to talk and receive telepathic conversations, because with gray aliens, all communication is telepathic. There's no indication whatsoever that they have vocal cords or that they make sounds. That's a serious study. So that might be it. It might be just the ability to find out where they are. We don't know. We just don't know. We don't know that. But we do know that there is this intergenerational link that we know for an absolute fact. As much as I can ever say absolute facts in this area. So the point is, though, that unfortunately, when they get married, and 95% of people don't know that they're abductees, when they get married to a non-abductee and they have 2 or 3 kids, almost certainly the 3 kids will be abductees. So what you have is one abductee making 3 abductees, and then they make more abductees. You see what I mean? So it spreads throughout the society. And I think that's what is happening, in fact. I can't get, we did a Roper-Hull poll some 20 years back, and what it showed was that young people were having these experiences in greater numbers than older people. Mm-hmm. Which makes no sense, because older people have had a longer time to remember, to have memories, to have bleed through memories, to think things are odd, you know what I mean? If they're 70 years old and they look back at their life and think, well, you know, a lot of odd things have happened to me. But when you're 18, not a whole lot of odd has happened unless you're an abductee. And so what we got was a spread of larger numbers of younger people were answering abductee questions on this. Nobody knew it was about the abduction phenomenon, but they were answering questions affirmatively that abductees were answering in our pre-testing at an 80% level. And non-abductees were answering at a very, very, very low level, 5%, 1%, you know. And they were answering it at a very high level. So that shows you that spreading out in the society, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, would a skeptic's or debunker's opinion be the multi-generational part of it is because of influence of that parent?
Most parents don't know that they're abductees at all.
Okay.
They think that they've seen religious figures. They've traveled on the astral plane. They've had dead people, their relatives come back to them in the middle of the night and say everything is going to be okay. They've had all sorts of odd experiences, not one of which they would chalk up to being an abductee. And when their little kids say, Mommy, 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 these big people, big-headed people are coming into my room and they're taking me away, they say, there, there, there. No, no, it's just a dream, just a dream. And they truly, absolutely, and 100% believe it was just a dream. So it's the opposite of reinforcing, oh, my God, you're being abducted by gray aliens. It's the opposite of that for most families.
How does that come out, then, that they were abducted, the older people?
Well, what happens is that I will ask a person, you know, what about your mom or your dad? Did they ever have unusual experience? Well, my mother saw an owl once who stared into the window for 2 hours, and she was sort of riveted on its eyes. And my father once, you know, and they'll describe all these odd circumstances that the mother or the father has had. I've worked with mothers and fathers of adult children. Not fathers, mothers of abduct children, I should say. Of adult children, and in fact, they are abductees. They know it. They learn that I take myself as a baseline. The only odd thing that is ever happens to me on a routine basis is I'll forget to watch something on television that I wanted to watch. That's my life. Whereas abductees have lives filled with oddities that their friends don't necessarily have, but they just incorporate them into this is normal. This is how, and this is, I'm human, and this is just normal. Nothing's wrong with me, and there isn't anything wrong with them either. They're abductees, and they don't fully understand that. If you have a poll and you ask people if you're an abductee or not, about 1 million people will say yes. Those are the people who know. Probably anywhere from anywhere from 2 to 5% of the public are actually abductees, from what we can tell. And that's, I don't know what 5% of 300 million is, but it's a hell of a lot. Mm-hmm. 15 million people minimum.
Yep.
So, you know, and so we know that the vast majority of people who are abductees don't know it. All abductees that I've talked to have had a parent that's had odd experiences.
Wow. All?
All of them. Yeah, they all do. Hmm. And they all say, I think it comes down to my father because he saw ghosts. He saw this. He used to talk about that and this and that. And so it's just, we just keep finding it. Not only that, they all have kids who are abductees as well. An unbelievably sensitive area to go into because it leads to guilt and a feeling of unable to protect their children. Doing hypnosis with abductees is a very tricky and delicate business, and one must be very, very careful for all of those out there who might think of doing this kind of work. You're delving into people's private and personal lives and dealing with them on a very human level that it's not easy to do. It's obviously common sense, but there's an awful lot of people who just are kind of like a bull in a china shop, and they, you know, and when I deal with people, their lives come first. The getting the information from them comes second. That's the way I look at it.
Anything in particular you'd like to close this interview with?
Well, you know, one of the books that's mainly written is a book about how to do hypnosis with abductees. And this is going to be a manual for aimed at the therapeutic community, but therapists are not going to be involved with that. Nobody's interested in the subject. But for those people who are interested, I hope to try to regularize the field a little bit so that telling them, you know, about the problems of confabulation and how to get around it, and the problems of doing an event that a person thinks is a dream and may not be, and sometimes is a dream, you know. But and if a person says A, then what's the answer that the researcher has to tell them? What's the question, rather, that they have to say to them? And if they answer B, then or C, then they have to say something else. And I'm kind of doing it on a word by word level, a question and answer level, you know, to make this sort of manual for how to do hypnosis with abductees. So I do want other people who are serious, responsible people, hopefully in the academic community, but that's not going to happen. Because I don't want to be out there alone. There's only a few of us, a Carpenter, there's Yvonne Smith. There's only a few of us. And I want other people to prove me wrong, you know, prove me wrong. That's fine. I can live with that. That's great. I'd love to be wrong. I have no ego at stake in this. I want to be wrong. Wonderful. Great. I'll take it. So go ahead and prove it. Do this work yourself. So hopefully this book will help that. This is the second book I'm working on.
And when do you expect that might be to press?
Well, I figure that the market for this book is probably in the tens and tens. So I'll have that one printed up most likely, unless I can get some off-name press to publish it for me.
Okay. And where would someone find you, David?
My website is ufoabduction.com, and that's just ufoabductionsingular.com.
Very good. Well, this has been really fascinating. You've been a great guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Martin. I appreciate it.
So this is Martin Willis with David Jacobs, PhD, and that's it for today. A couple of announcements. I do want to say thank you to a couple of people that donated last week. I really appreciate that. And our donation button is right on our sidebar. You can follow us on Twitter or you can like us on Facebook. And those icons are right on our website. You can contact me at info@podcastufo.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show today.